The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
In some ways, completely fitting to have Run DMC Walk This Way as the bumper music leading into our next in-studio special guest. He has walked this way, and he's about to walk that way, right out of the state of Colorado. It's the interim chief of police for the next 15 minutes or something like that, Dan Oates. Dan, thanks for joining us.
George, happy to be here.
Man, it's great to have you back in. It feels like it was just 10 minutes ago you were sitting across from me on your way into this job. When was that? Remind us.
It was over 6 months ago.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You have a bigger smile on your face today than you did coming into the job. First off, logistically speaking, when does the new interim chief take over?
Well, he gets sworn in tonight, so I guess I'm technically still the police chief until about 6:30 tonight.
Okay. So fingers crossed. I mean, do you just walk around hoping nothing happens?
Well, he and I are going to spend a day together, and nothing is going to happen.
And then has he been here enough to do, I guess in the military I'd call it a right seat ride, where it's like he kind of shotguns you for a while and then you shotgun him?
We've spent a lot of time together. We spent most of yesterday together, so it's been a lot of me briefing him on issues and hooked him up with his police car yesterday, helped him move boxes into the office, and we had dinner together last night.
Nice.
So he's plugged in. So.
Now, my belief is I have suckered your PIO into having him sit where you are, I hope, a week from today. So we'll get that introduction and all that, too.
Yeah, he's spending this week getting grounded, and next week he's going to be all his interviews. And I think that's great. He's focusing on the department this week, and I think that's exactly right. The cops need to feel his presence first.
So. Now, listen, you were tapped to come in here for some big, important, and obvious reasons, and that is this is the second largest police department in the state of Colorado. For a lot of reasons, people that listen to this station and who have just lived here know, it is as consequential a police department to its community as any that are out there. And there was a period of time there where it just seemed like we were having trouble finding our footing. It was in a bit of a disarray from the outsider's perspective. And you got asked to come in and do this thing. It's now 6+ months later, and we'll get into some of the lessons learned and all that. But is there another one of these left in you to go do this?
I don't think so. It's 40 years, and I'm pretty exhausted by this last experience. I mean, you never say never. But I think it's time. You know, I turned 68 in January. It's time to focus on family and grandchildren and golf.
Mm-hmm. You're headed back to Detroit?
No, stop.
Oh, yeah.
I'm headed back to our home is just northeast of Orlando. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
How often do you head out to the amusement parks?
I haven't in a while, but there was a period with my granddaughter I was going regularly, and might get back into that, so we'll see.
Me and two of my boys that I know of are going to be out there January 5th through the 9th on my way to Sarasota. So if you're thinking about going to the park, we ought to hook up, do a couple rides, you know,
okay.
That kind of thing.
All right, let me know.
When you're looking in the rearview mirror now at this 6 months, how does the department, in your opinion, compare today to how it was when you left years ago before Nick came
well,
on board?
Well, it's a complicated question. First of all, the world has changed. American policing has changed, and the expectations and demands on American policing has changed. I left in mid-14, so I left 8 years ago. And the organization at the time was riding high. During my 8.5 years here, the men and women of the department had reduced major crime by 30%.
Oh, man.
We were in high standing because of our spectacular response to the theater shooting.
Yep.
I thought we had excellent relationships with all the key community stakeholders. And to come back 8 years later and have the organization in crisis, all the criticisms of the post-George Floyd, Elijah McClain era, it was very painful because probably 60% of the cops who were here in 14 were still here when I came back. And they're the same wonderful cops doing really, really hard work every single day. But the reputation of the organization had been trashed. And this is one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. If only that because I think I helped stabilize the organization and make people feel good about the organization again.
How do you do that? When you come in under these circumstances, which were different than when you first took over way back when?
Well, I joke. I think 80% of a police chief's job is just showing up.
Yeah.
You know, it's being everywhere, being seen by the cops, being a cheerleader. There were a handful of things that I did, for instance, forming a proactive team, what we call our DART team, our Direction, Action, Response team. There was a training segment we did in the third quarter, a one-day training segment in July in which I spoke to every single member of the organization for an hour about sort of the need and the encouragement to get back to work, back to proactive policing, and then the rest of that day was spent working on scenario training where cops were encouraged that, yes, you can do police work. You can put your hands on people when you have to. Don't worry about the recent state law changes. If you do what you're trained to do, the city will protect you. The city will back you up. So that kind of messaging. And frankly, I had a pretty good reputation with the cops when I left. And I think that was reassuring. I've never felt in my entire career, you know, my 18 plus years as a police chief, I've never felt more respected, supported, accepted by the cops than I have in these last 6 months. I mean, to be a police chief is to have so many demands from so many different quarters. And, you know, cops are very, very demanding workforce, and they're often critical of who's ever in charge. But I never felt that during the last 6 months. I think it's kind of been a love fest. And
that's great.
And so I'm leaving on, you know, for me personally, on a very high note. I absolutely love the place. It's been the highlight of my career to work here and to come back here for 6 months. So
You've set the bar to place it's going to be a little bit awkward for the interim chief to come in. And that is you don't ever want to follow John Elway or Peyton Manning into the huddle. Do you know what I mean? Like, you would rather follow, apparently, Russell Wilson into the huddle because that's not going very well. But that is something that you benefited from, too. But you talked about your reputation with the officers. I get all that stuff. The community itself, there were folks that were supportive of your predecessor in this role, the last permanent chief right. That we had had. How did you navigate that change? When you going back out into the community, how do you re-engage them with, listen, we need to work together on this?
Well, again, I had been here almost 9 years. So just about every key community leader who is focused on or knows the police department or is making demands of the police department already knew me. You know, that was the advantage of me coming back here, is that just as I stepped comfortably into the organization that I knew well, I also knew the community well. So I didn't get or sense any sort of pushback from any quarter for my time here, including some of the most vocal critics of the department in the lead up to my arrival. People have treated me great, and communication with them has been great. So just really not an issue. My successor, Art Acevedo, he's very, very good at community relations and community dialogue, and he'll fit in comfortably. And by the way, I don't know if you saw his press conference where he was announced.
No. Huh.
One-third of the questions were in Spanish, and Art is bilingual. And he handled it great. But the change that is for this department, we've never had a bilingual, you know, prominent city leader, and 30% of our community is Hispanic. And that's just such a great opportunity for the department to communicate in a new and different way to a huge segment of our community, and also for Art to get established here. So I'm very excited for Art's arrival. And, you know, he's taking it on an interim basis. He's trying out Aurora. Aurora's trying him out. You know, my hope, in fact, my expectation is 6 months from now, we as a community will be begging Art to stay. So my hope.
And he'll want to stay.
My hope is that he will, you know. So so we'll see. But I'm very excited for the future with Art coming in. He's a veteran, experienced police chief. He's run a couple of very tough cities to run. So You know, I'm very hopeful for him. So.
Now, before you leave, of course, at the end of this 3-hour interview, we'll talk about the surprise announcement about the new patches on the shoulders that you're going to be launching. That is a little bit of an inside joke for anyone at Aurora PD right there. We'll get to that in a bit. We talk about the community engagement piece. That part sounds like it was relatively stable, at least in terms of the points of contact and the leaders and all that other stuff. What about the city government, though? What's different today about either city council, city manager, than when you were here last?
Oh, I don't know. It's kind of obvious to everyone there's kind of a left and right divide in the current city council.
Oh, yeah.
But listen, I've worked for 18 years in 3 cities for so many different councils, and it's the democratic process, you know, and your job as a manager of a department is to work with the other managers, the other directors of the other departments as a team with the city manager to deliver what democracy demands. So whatever the council is, they are who we work for. I'll never forget a graduation speech an elected congressman once gave at one of our police academy graduations. He said, that oath that you take is really to become a police officer is really to our notions of Western democracy. You know, when you take that oath to be a police officer, you take an oath to abide by the guidance of, your elected leaders. So there might be a little bit of a divide right now on the council, but in the end, they provide guidance and instruction, and they set policy, and our job is to do what and to perform to their expectations. And sometimes as a chief, you have to remind cops, the legislature passed a law we don't like, or the council is demanding, these new expectations of the police department. Hey, that's what we signed up for. We signed up for to be responsive to the people, and that's how it works. So, but I've gotten to know each of the 11 council members individually. They all want the same thing. They want the best things for Aurora, and they're all very supportive of the police. So, it's been sort of typical of my 18 years in 3 cities in terms of how we relate to the council.
Not to make it awkward, but you are on your way out of town. Who's the worst city councilman?
Oh, no,
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm joking. You did bring up, though, the idea of being bound by the laws that the legislature passes. And you know this, that in the state of Colorado, back in 2019, we passed a red flag law that is now resurgent in the news because of what took place down south of us. And there are some sheriffs who have said, hey, I'm a constitutional officer and I'm not going to do this. And some who are not going to do that. How in the 6 months that you've been back, because we didn't have this law before when you were here, we didn't have this. How have you guys approached that particular issue?
When we think it's appropriate, we're going for a protective order to take guns away. It's not happening frequently, but when there's a legitimate reason to be concerned, we act on it. There's no qualms about that. In terms of public policy, it's a good thing. And I think it's foolish on the part of some of these law enforcement officials to say we will never do that. It's a tool that's available to us, and we've taken advantage of it when we think it's appropriate.
That you've used the language I've used is it's a tool in the toolbox. I just can't imagine looking in there and saying there's no circumstance under which I'd ever pull that one out. I just can't see any situation like that. There's going to be some, and we've seen this from some Republican sheriffs who earlier said, hey, I don't like this law, I'll never use it, who actually ended up doing it. Like, there's no other recourse. Like, this is the thing that we have to try to protect the community.
Right. And as we've seen, when you don't do that, the first people, when really bad things happen, the human mind looks for a rational explanation for it and wants an explanation that sort of resolves it for us going forward. And too often in our career, we cops are closest to the bad outcome. So the first question asked is, what did you do to prevent it? So it's a tool that's available, and we are seeing in some places in the country where the cops don't take advantage of that tool, this criticism is directed at the cops rather than at the bad guy who did the bad thing. So our agency embraces the use of the tool when it's necessary.
We're talking with Dan Oates. He's the interim chief of police for Aurora. for the next, I don't know, until the end of this segment. And then I think we both go off the air probably forever. I want to get the benefit of your expertise and your advice on this. I'm not looking to make you a legislator or a policymaker, but as you look back over your career, clearly one of the, maybe the most high-profile thing you had to confront, and you handled it well, really well, was the Aurora Theater Massacre. Unprecedented kind of in its size, its scope, the amount of resources on it. Have you ever gone back in your mind and thought to yourself, is there, and this is natural, what could we have done? Not we as a police department, but what could we as society have done in advance to have headed that off at the pass or to try to prevent another one of those in the future? What's missing from what we had available to us?
Well, in his case, there was an opportunity to intervene. I mean, most of these shooters, there are signals. And so as a society, we have to have the courage when there are indicators that someone is thinking this way, that we be more aggressive and intervene. I mean, George, the big issue after 40 years, okay, there's too many damn guns on the street, okay, in the hands of irresponsible people. We have to have some sort of way of controlling the access to weapons by people who shouldn't have them. The level of violence in the Denver metro area today and the number of folks who are resolving disputes using weapons, especially young people, especially juveniles, having been away for 8 years, that's been the biggest shock for me coming back. As an example, and again, I've spoken to chiefs in the area. I spent a whole lot of time talking to Paul Pazin about what was going on in Denver before he retired. But as an example, when I was here back in 14, we used to have 35 to 50 non-fatal shootings a year in Aurora. That number this year will be over 200.
Okay. What?
So that's a, you know, and we're no different than Denver or anybody else in terms of those numbers. We've just hit our 43rd or 44th homicide this year. When I was here back in 14, a typical year we had 15 to 20. My highest year was the year of the theater shooting.
Of course, you had 12.
We had 28, but 12 of them were in the theater.
Yeah. Right.
So we're at 43 this year. And I don't want to say this is an Aurora problem. This is a Colorado problem, and the data shows that. The auto thefts here, absolutely through the roof. So I'm concerned about Colorado and about crime. And it isn't that the cops aren't working their butts off, because they are. And I'm out there with them, and I see it. Our criminal justice system is an ecosystem, and it's not, you know, it involves everybody else beside the cops. And it's not working well. We don't have enough bed space for violent juveniles. And I've had any number of incidents.
Good point.
I've had any number of incidents in the last 6 months where we've arrested juveniles for really violent crimes, and they've gotten back on the street to commit still more horrific and violent crimes.
It's something that folks don't know listening that Dan's talking about is the legislature has imposed caps on bed space that are wholly arbitrary and completely disconnected from the level of crime. And so that if a judge is confronted with, do I put this kid in a bed? They are by choice removing another kid from that bed. There is no way to grow into a crime wave with juveniles.
And I'll give one example, and I could name 10 for my 6 months here. We had an incident about 6 weeks ago in which a juvenile that we had arrested for violent robberies, okay, the answer is give him an ankle monitor. Well, he cuts the ankle monitor off. He's driving a stolen car occupied by 7 other juveniles. And at the point of impact in which he hits another family that's just turning, broadsides another family, it's just turning into their neighborhood, mother, father, 2 infants in the back seat. At the point of impact, he was doing 96 miles an hour.
Oh, good Lord.
One of the juveniles in the stolen car that he was driving died. And that family is messed up forever. The parents had very bad injuries. The children in the back seat were okay, they had some injuries, but just staggeringly reckless and irresponsible behavior.
How old is the driver?
15. So we had the shooting last week.
Yep.
One of the people we've captured, one of the people involved, 16 years old, non-functioning ankle monitor, based on prior behavior. He was out, and he opens fire on police officers. I still don't know how many rounds were fired. You know, the Arapahoe County CERT team is investigating that, not us. Just, you know, shocking behavior. But it is a, you know, number one concern. I've spoken at length with John Kellner, your predecessor at the 18th.
Successor, yeah.
Your successor,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
At the 18th. And, you know, he's well aware of this. And, you know, again, I think we need more. A reasonable investment by the legislature would be more bed space for violent juveniles.
Can you stick around?
Sure.
I mean, I've got a bunch more that I want to talk to you about. Some of it would be career ending if you weren't already going to end your own career. So I'm hopeful to get into that stuff when we come back. Dan Oates, the interim chief of police for Aurora. One of the questions I want to ask is, are too many good officers being stuck in public information? We'll talk about that when we come back. It's George Brockler on The George Show, 710 KNUS. It's the stairway to the Orlando area for Dan Oates, the interim chief from Aurora Police, with us until I think he almost punches out. Thanks for sticking around with us.
Absolutely.
We were talking off air. We might as well just get it going here because it's such an important piece to this larger law enforcement public safety puzzle, and that is recruiting and retention of law enforcement. What are you seeing out there?
Well, you know, I'm ending a 40-year career, and 40 years ago, these jobs are very desirable. And today, it's probably the darkest time in the profession for recruiting. We're down 50 positions. We're offering a great salary.
Oh, my goodness. Alpha, how big? Give us a sense of how big the department is.
I think roughly our number right now is 750, and we're at 700. So we're paying a great salary, starting salary of 65. After 4 years, you're making 105.
And that's, what?
And that's before
– Billy, we're going to be cops.
Hey, we're hiring. We're hiring. Well – so, and that's before overtime. That's before any special assignment pay of any kind. You know, and so at the moment, we're among the highest paid cops in the state.
Wow.
And it's recruitment is a national problem. And here's why. And every police chief of a major city is having a challenge in this regard. Think about the kind of folks we would hire. They'd be, you know, young folks in their early 20s, mid 20s. What have they been exposed to in their formative years, that would attract them to our profession? Just look at the coverage of our profession in the last 5 years. And what do, as they're growing up, what do adults around them say about our profession? What does the media say about our profession? And, you know, it's a very, very tight job market, and everybody's short on personnel at the moment. And under those circumstances, people are not attracted to the job the way they should be. And it's a great career. It's as rewarding as can be. So much opportunity, especially in a large department like Aurora, where we have all kinds of special assignments. And over the course of a 25, 30-year career, you can do so many different and varied things. But we, like all major police departments, are struggling in recruitment. And it's sad. I worry about the profession, and I worry about the future. And it is true that cops can impact crime. We can make a difference. If I had 50 more cops today, we could truly make Aurora safer. And I'm sure that the chief in Denver would say the same thing. And other
it's not a question
cities.
Of budget, though. Like, you have the budget
oh,
for
yes.
the 50 cops?
Absolutely. And so what we're doing is our vacancy savings are we're spending on overtime. And we're actually right now we've been in a period for some time where we're ordering or forcing cops to work additional shifts on overtime, and,
wow.
and they're exhausted. And it's a challenge, and it's again, it's not unique to Aurora. It's happening all over the country.
It's not the generational part concerns me, because if we lose an entire generation to the idea that law enforcement is a noble, honorable, meaningful profession, that doesn't just stop with that generation. It will trickle down into their kids and then their kids and all that. It's going to be a tough road. But the other part that you'd mentioned off air was, look, there's a real interest here in trying to recruit from inside the community and have a police department that's able to draw from all quarters, all socioeconomic things. And because of what's going on out there, we are losing the ability to do that.
Yeah, and you know, throughout my entire career, recruiting especially from the minority community. So every police chief in America wants a workforce that reflects the diversity of their community, okay? But particularly in the minority community, what is the messaging that has been sent to the 20-somethings of today in the minority community about among the adults that they've grown up with, you know, their parents, people that they respect in the adult world? What's the message they've told them about policing as a profession? It's not good. And so we're doubly challenged to recruit from the minority community. Again, it's very exciting that we're having a bilingual Hispanic new police chief, and I think Art's gonna he'll make an impact in that regard. But we as a profession need to do the best that we can to recruit, and the best that we can to recruit for diversity. And it's been a theme throughout my 18 years as a police chief, but it's never been a more challenging time, and I worry about the profession.
At the same time that you're being confronted with these recruiting, retention, morale issues that are bigger than just Aurora, at the same time, at least in Colorado, we are seeing an undeniable shift from the legislature in what it means to hold someone accountable. And that shows up at the front end, where we no longer hold anybody in jail anymore until they've stolen two or three cars in a 3 or 4 month period. And then on the back end, we don't send anybody to prison anymore. We don't send anybody to jail. We are a very permissive, forgiving criminal justice system, especially for property crimes, but even on some persons' crimes. What I appreciate about what Aurora has done, and it can't take place without you, but it definitely has to take place with the city council, is that is to say, and I take this as a bit of a slap at the state system, and that is, you are failing us on property crimes, specifically, let's say car theft. You've told us, and I agree, it's shooting through the roof. We're no longer going to rely upon the state system to handle these cases. We think we can get a better product right here locally with a lower class charge, but with some mandatory time. Tell me your thoughts on that and the potential for it. And then two, the DART program that you restarted up. Tell us how that works hand in hand with that.
So first off, with regard to auto theft, and this is not a new idea. When I came here back in 05, we started charging, it's counterintuitive, we started charging auto theft as a misdemeanor. In our municipal court, and we have a municipal court, and we have municipal judges who can sentence someone for up to a year. So we wrote auto theft into the municipal court as a misdemeanor offense, and the judges started giving jail time. I forget what it was at the time. It was like 30 days for a first offense and 90 days for a second offense, and then I think it was a year for a third offense. And that and some other initiatives really drove down auto theft. And we had a great success while I was here those 8 years in reducing crime. Because if you go to jail, even if for only 30 days for an auto theft, okay, that's an unpleasant experience.
Oh, yeah.
And it sends a message. So we were known for that. You know, you don't want to be driving a stolen car in Aurora. Somehow we got away from that. I was gone for 8 years. And with the leadership of a couple of council members, they recently passed a municipal ordinance making it mandatory. Now, I haven't seen what the impact of that has been yet. It's going to take some time to see what the data shows. But we're back to that concept. And then on top of that, they've added some mandatory sentencing for shoplifting. I think it's over $300. It's like I forget what it is.
That was a Daniel Jurinski thing that she led. Yeah, I remember that.
So, those are small but important messages that are being sent out into the community about, don't engage in shoplifting in Aurora. And nationally, there's this huge trend where there are prosecutors who aren't prosecuting for these low-level property offenses. And there's, in some of our major cities, there's places like Duane Reade's and Walgreens that are going out of business. Like I said, the criminal justice exists as an ecosystem, and there are a lot of things that work and don't work. But the one thing is, if you spend a career in policing, you know that there is a place for punishment as a deterrence. It's not the solution to everything, and we can't arrest our way out of all problems. But punishment has its place as a deterrence. And again, we get back to the examples I've given you about juveniles and some of the horrible things I've seen in the 6 months I've been here. All those incidents involve juveniles that had already engaged in truly awful offenses But we're out again, and you know, I guess the message, especially you know, if you've any of us who are parents, you know what teenagers mm-hmm. are like. If there's no sanction for your behavior, you do more bad behavior. So
this is a little different, but in the same zip code as that conversation. You remember the Columbine shooters right. had also been through the system on a vehicle trespass, and they had been serving a deferred judgment when they committed their act. One of the two shooters at STEM, which took place in May of 2019, was also on a deferred judgment for a drug distribution near overdose event that took place at their prior high school. So juvenile involvement in the system, I think we want to tell ourselves we've created a system where we're focused on rehabilitation, which we want. I don't want juveniles to be treated just like adults on all these things. But we've gotten to a point where it is no longer, it seems like, having the kind of impact that we wanted on some of these kids.
I agree. I think we need to get a handle on juvenile crime and take it more seriously here in Colorado.
Is your sense, at least for the adults piece of this thing, does it matter more, and in terms of driving down crime, for there to be a larger class charge, like a felony, or the jail? And I think I know the answer based on the experiment that you guys engaged in after you took over back in the mid-2000s. Is it I don't care if it's a felony or a misdemeanor for these property crimes. If you put in the promise of some loss of liberty, that is going to have a bigger impact.
Yes, the answer is yes to that, the second part, the latter. It's the loss of liberty that is the accountability. And again, it's not for everyone, but there's a point at which that's what's needed. So.
When you look at what you guys have done this time around, are you starting to see numbers that make a difference?
Well, the short answer is this. We track crime, okay, as a manager, all right? This is what I learned from Bill Bratton, my time in the NYPD. You can't ask cops to reduce crime year to date, but you can ask cops to reduce recent crime or trend crime. So we measure crime in Aurora in 28-day periods. So we look at the most recent 28 days, and we compare it to the most recent prior 28 days. And that's your trend line. That's your trend information. We have been trending down in nearly all categories now for about 3 months over every 28-day snapshot. That has to do, I think, with a couple of things. I think I had an impact in having cops relax and sort of get back to work and feel good about doing police work again. But also we did some you know, we have serious crime strategy meetings twice a month actually. And we formed the DART team, which is the other thing you wanted to talk
about.
Yeah. With all the demands on the organization, there was no per se proactive team that, you know, wasn't responding to the radio but was doing strategic deployment around violent crime. So the directed action response team was a concept from years ago. It had faded away, and we scraped the organization when I got here to find 16 positions to form a proactive team. And as tight as staffing was, we did, and we put them out in areas and time of day, and basically to suppress non-fatal shootings, robberies, and back to auto theft. What is happening now across America and is happening in Colorado is more and more a violent felony starts with a stolen car. I can't tell you how many times in the 6 months I've been here where we're looking at a violent felony and it's committed. You know, everyone has to get to and from the location of the felony. How do they get there? The first thing everybody does now is steal a car. So the DART team is out looking for stolen cars and acting on pattern information and trend information in certain areas, and they've had an impact, I believe, in driving crime down. So we've been trending positively for the last couple of months, but we've also had a number of violent confrontations. The most recent one being last week, which your listeners may or may not know about. But the DART team was tracking a stolen car, looking for the right opportunity to try and stop the drivers. You know, you don't want to get involved in a pursuit because vehicle pursuits are so dangerous. So
right.
They were following the car and looking for, you know, if they stopped to get a snack at a, you know, 7-Eleven or they stopped for gas, then we would move in and make the arrest. It was a confirmed steal. the people in the car suddenly opened fire on our officers.
Oh, boy.
And we had a major, basically a gun battle where
what are the age of the shooters?
Well, we've arrested one, and he was 16.
Good grief.
Okay, and he had a non-functioning ankle monitor because he had been arrested for prior violent crimes, and that was the solution because there was no bed space for him. And he's one of the at least two people who shot at us. We made that arrest on Saturday. We actually grabbed him that night, but we couldn't tie him to the event without further investigation. So 3 days later, we had that information, and we got the arrest warrant signed on Saturday. So, but that's an example where proactive policing identified a stolen car, and it led to that confrontation. We had, you know, five officers return fire. But, you know, in the way we do things now in our profession, for everybody's good, they're on administrative leave for a period of time to decompress.
Sure.
But now the DART team is halved because those cops are now not on the street.
And I take it that, as you pointed out, I think earlier, CIRT, the CERT team from the DA's office, is taking a look at that.
Yeah, they investigate it under state law now. We do not do our own investigations of our officer-involved shootings, and that's good public policy in the current environment. I have no reason to think that these cops did anything other than be totally heroic and courageous, but my responsibility as the head of the agency is to let the CERT team investigation take its course. But you know, I'm very proud of the DART team. I'm very proud of the entire department and the focus on crime reduction in the 6 months I've been here.
You have the ability to stick around for one more break.
Sure.
Normally wouldn't take you an hour because I know how busy you are, but I look at you now and I feel like
I'm not that busy today, George.
This
is my last day.
My guess is it was a struggle to not show up in sweats like I did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we could have both been in hoodies today, but for Faith, I imagine.
Yeah.
Listen, we're talking with Dan Oates. He's the interim chief of police for Aurora for less than 24 hours before the new chief takes over. Getting some final thoughts on the policing, public safety on one of the most significant cities in the metro area. I think it's going to be home to the next Denver Broncos stadium if the Denver Broncos can survive this season. We'll talk more with Dan just after this. It's George Brockman on the George Show, 710 KNUS. It is our final few moments with outgoing interim chief of police for Aurora PD. You just don't get access to someone who has operated at the levels Dan Oates has like this. So I want to take up every possible moment to allow you to just talk to us about as you're leaving this, which what you've said is, and maybe it's a Tom Brady thing, like I am definitely retiring and then you show back up for the Buccaneers or something, but what are your final thoughts on this? What are your words to not just Aurora, but to Colorado as you leave here? Optimism, pessimism, concern, what?
Oh, with regard to Aurora PD, definitely optimism. I think we have an exciting, dynamic new chief coming in. And I think we're going to turn the corner on our hiring challenges in this year. And I think the profession is sort of climbing out of the dark last couple of years. And I mean, it's just a great job. I mean, I look back at my 40 years. You know, I started as a Manhattan street cop, had a wonderful time in the NYPD for 21 years and worked in three other cities, Ann Arbor, Aurora, Miami Beach as a chief, and now back here. I've seen and done so many wonderful things and worked with so many wonderful people. It is a great and noble profession. And one of the things about it is you come to work and on a given day, you don't know what's going to happen, but you're out there, you know, helping people. So it's, you know, the future will be bright. I think we're climbing out of the darkness, and people are beginning to realize that, you know, we need cops, and we need high-performing cops. So
what's that metric that you've looked to as you've gone through your 18 years as a chief to say, I know we're making a difference in this way? It could be the crime rate, but what else do you
look
at?
Well, I came of age as an executive under Bill Bratton in the turnaround in New York City in the 90s. So it is, in fact, okay, the crime rate. If you are reducing crime, every one of those statistics is a victim. And if there is less victimization, we are doing our job. It's the number one reason we're there, is to keep communities safe. And if there's a message I learned from the greatest police leader in American history, Bill Bratton, it's that cops can make a difference. In the 80s, crime was out of control. And it's fun to be a street cop when crime is out of control, but we weren't strategic. And many times we were just taking reports. And in the 90s, American policing changed, starting in New York City when I was there, because, you know, Bratton infused in us a sense that we are the cops and we can make a difference. And if we deploy strategically and we hold ourselves accountable and we do our best to hold the rest of the criminal justice system accountable, we can make a difference on crime. And I took that training and that experience, and over my time as a police chief in all three cities, the men and women who I worked with responded to my focus on crime reduction, and I was successful in leading those organizations to reduce crime in all three cities. The 8 years we were here, I was here in Aurora from 05 to 14, 8.5 years, the men and women of Aurora PD reduced major index crime by 30%.
Is that reproducible here?
I think it is. I think, you know, Colorado, our legislature has made some mistakes in terms of loosening up penalties and accountability. And I think, you know, beginning to come around. For instance, the changes on auto theft.
Yeah.
There's now talk about reforming them or fixing them in the legislature beginning in January and reinstituting the penalties that were in place for years.
Yes and no. So what they're talking about doing is making it all felonies. Like any time you steal a car, it's a felony regardless of value. That matters. But based on our conversation, the piece that's missing is not the classification of charge, but it's that promise of we're going to take you off the streets. That's what's missing.
And I think we're probably going to come around to that. I mean, when Rudy Giuliani took office in January of 94 in New York, and Bill Bratton became the police commissioner, there was a political will because that city was fed up with crime. And that's why crime was reduced in the 90s in New York. So, yes, cops can make a difference. If there's a message I want to leave the profession with, is that we can make a difference and reduce victimization.
Listen, I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about the magic that is the civil service reform that's going out there in Aurora. Darn it. I know you are really anxious to jump in on that.
Well, we do need major civil service reform in Aurora if we're going to improve our hiring prospects. And we'll leave that for another day, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's going to happen, by the way. I think you have the right people. In fact, I had Councilman Zvonik on here last week, and he said he thinks it's going to be a 10-0 vote in favor of it. So that's a plus.
Yep, and that's what Aurora needs.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I can't believe this is the last time we may have you in studio ever. Dan Oates, man, thanks for joining us. It has been a hell of a time. I got to know you over one of the craziest things that's ever taken place in Aurora or anywhere else. So thanks for being here, man.
And thank you. And thank you for your leadership on the prosecution of the shooter in the Aurora Theater.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
Hey, when we come back, we're going to change it up here as we say goodbye to Dan. It is me, George Brockler, right here on The George Show, 710 KNUS.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.